This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's the annual Spring Migration Bird Show here on Vermont Edition. A perennial favorite, we always love having bird diva Bridget Butler back in the studio to share observations and enthusiasm about all the feathered things. Bridget, welcome back.
Tweet, tweet to you, Jane.
I know, it's so fun. It's just, I mean, I think you don't have to be a bird lover or even a bird watcher to notice that the birds come back in the springtime and to feel the joy. I mean, it feels to me like one day you're out riding around and there's nothing in the sky, and the next day those raptors are just swirling around the hills. It's kind of amazing.
Right, or the Phoebe is just singing his little heart out. I heard one right as I walked into the station this morning.
It's a great time, and listeners, if you want to chime in with what you've been seeing, or if you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your bird sightings and your bird photos on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We talk sometimes on this show, Bridget, about the schedule, the migration schedule. So what's coming into our neighborhoods?
Yeah,
sure.
So what's really interesting is through a lot of the work that biologists have done, ornithologists have done, and people just like you and me who report birds all the time through things like eBird, we're able to track when birds arrive and depart our area. So right now, we have a lot of birds that are coming back from wherever they've been for the wintertime, getting ready for the breeding season. And our sightings kind of help track that because it can shift and change. And of course, this year, you know, the weather was a little bit iffy. So winter's kind of holding on, digging its claws in there. And so birds are probably maybe a little bit more reluctant. And what I love is when I track things like song sparrow arrived back in my yard this week, I could follow, oddly enough, on Facebook that I reported that I saw a song sparrow in my yard same week last year. Pretty cool. And so this is the time of year as we get into April. We're in this third week of April and things are really going to start to pick up. So red-winged blackbirds arrive back in February. There's our sign of spring.
Oh, let me tell you, Bridget, this year we had a red-winged blackbird who stayed at my bird feeder in Moncton all winter long.
Wow, that is a hardcore red-winged blackbird.
Either well, and I asked Brian confused. Pfeiffer, one of our other bird friends, and I said, is this rare? And he said, oh no, it's not rare. There have been 25 sightings.
Yeah.
Which to me sounds still pretty rare.
Still pretty rare, right? And that's the bird that we think of as the harbinger of spring here. But, you know, as we trickle in through April and into May, May is that peak migration season where we're really looking for the eye candy birds, like all the warblers and such. But this week, this is a really great week because swallows are going to start to show up. So we have a whole set of swallows in the area. Tree swallow is probably the most common. But then we've got northern rough-wing swallow, cliff swallow, barn swallow, and purple martins as well. So those are some great birds to look for this week. There's a number of ways that you can figure out who's going to show up when. There's a great book by our friend Brian Pfeiffer called Birdwatching in Vermont. He's got a bunch of pages in the back that kind of will tell you who's going to show up when. You can also visit the webpage of our friends the Mad Birders from the Mad River Valley, and they have a great printout that you can use about seasonal bird arrivals. And then, of course, if you're tracking birds in your backyard and you're keeping a field notebook, that's something that you can enjoy year after year and track who's coming back when right in your backyard.
You mentioned, Bridget, that this winter was a pretty harsh winter and it stayed cold for a long time, and that you think maybe some birds are a little bit reluctant. But often, aren't they traveling by the light rather than what the actual temperature is?
Right. So birds are going to respond to light cues. So the longer days are going to cue them in that this is the time for them to move. And then we hope that spring is also enjoying that movement and that food sources will become available. So the light cue will tell them to go, but they're going to they've got to play off of what they can eat and the energy that they can pull together from whatever food sources are available out there. So we will still see things kind of show up on time, so to speak. But at the same time, there's this chance, like I think about ducks right now. Last year, Lake Carmi, the water was open at this point in time. So it was a great place to go and look for waterfowl. I was up there this week. It is still solid. Hopefully maybe this weekend now with these temperatures, we'll start to see the water open up. But so weather can kind of shift when birds are going to show up and be present.
Let's go to Susan, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Susan, you're on.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's a very timely program. I enjoy birds a lot. And yesterday there was a huge bird event in the south end of Burlington. There was a large flock of Bohemian waxwings. And I've seen them come before. They feed on the crab apples, but I've never seen a flock of this size. There were hundreds. I couldn't count.
Wow, Susan, that's very cool. Your phone line's a little bit wonky, so just for people who might not have heard that, Susan said in Burlington just yesterday she saw a huge flock of Bohemian waxwings, like 100 of them, and she's never seen that many at one time before.
Yeah, huge amount. So birds in the wintertime, especially these nomadic birds like Bohemian waxwings, they're going to flock up together. And when it gets tough finding food, they're going to add more to the flock, right? Because like more eyes makes it a lot easier to find food. And Bohemian waxwings are much like cedar waxwings. The big difference, you want to look at their butt, Jane. You got to get under that bird and look at the under tail cover. It's at that spot where the body and the tail kind of join. And sometimes that is a great spot to look at on birds for that field mark that's really going to help you clinch the ID. And on a Bohemian waxwing, it's a rusty red. So if you think you're seeing a cedar waxwing, I'm sorry, check the butt and you will know between cedar and Bohemian. Now, these guys do love the crab apples. And so a lot of the trees that are around in the area that are ornamental crabs are holding on to the fruit. Unfortunately, it ferments a little bit as it freezes and thaws. So you might have some drunk Bohemian waxwings like rolling around on the ground there. You know, give them some space, give them some time to sober up and move on their way. But they're going to rely on those fruits that are holding on to those crab apples.
I think Susan also wanted to know, she thought they were native to Canada, and she wonders why they're here.
Yeah, so these guys are going to breed up north, and like I said, they're nomadic. So that means they're going to respond to wherever the food is available. And we talk about this a lot on the Fall Bird Show, too. As we get ready for winter, we talk about eruptive species. And there's a guy that does...
And that's IRR.
Yes.
Eruptive.
Not like volcano.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a guy that does a report based on seed and fruit and mast, which would be beech or acorn crops, and the birds that are associated with those different type of food types. And so they will push depending on where the food is. And that's what Bohemian waxwings do.
All right. Heidi's calling in from Salisbury. Hey, Heidi.
Good morning. I'm just, or afternoon, I guess. I'm just calling to confirm that the swallows are here on time. I got up this morning and looked out my back window, and the tree swallows were swooping and soaring and spiraling all around to my great joy. And it tells me I need to get out and check my nest boxes and clean them out. So I just wanted to share
fabulous
my happiness this morning.
It is, and it's such a happy, like, joyous feeling. It's so funny how excited I got over a song sparrow. And in, like, 3 weeks, that guy will be, like, old news, right? But those first birds that start to trickle in, and it's very, very exciting. She mentioned also emptying nest boxes, which is a great thing to do, not only to put them up to help these cavity nesting birds like tree swallows. Chickadees like to nest in boxes as well. But you do want to make sure that you maintain them and clean them out. So folks that put birdhouses up for bluebirds or swallows or even owls, when we hit early April, that's a great time to go out and clean out those boxes so that they're ready for the birds when they get back.
Well, speaking of how we help the birds or don't help them, Lauren says, what's the best recommendation about feeding birds? Only in winter, all year round? Don't we have to take in our feeders when the black bears wake up?
Yeah, we do. And, you know, this has been an interesting thing that's popped up on some different feeds on Facebook lately. Mary Holland, who's the author of Naturally Curious, posted about taking your feeders down recently and had a response from someone else who said, well, if you do X, Y, and Z, you can actually keep your feeders protected from bears. Now, X, Y, and Z is like, put them on these industrial strength poles and get them way up high in the air. For me, the thing is that bear is still going to smell that seed. And the waste seed that's on the ground is still available and is still an attractant for the bears. So the recommendation by Audubon Vermont and me, I'm gonna put my mark on this too, is April through October, if you are in a place where it's likely that a black bear could wander through your neighborhood, you really want to take your feeders in. Now,
that's also the recommendation, I think, from Fish and Wildlife.
It's
April 1st to November 1st.
Yep.
No feeders.
No feeders.
Except hummingbird feeders.
Right. And you could put hummingbird feeders up. And then the next thing you can do is start planting a garden for birds. Shrubs, trees, and perennials that will attract not only the hummingbirds, but other birds during the year. So there's a way that we can keep that enjoyment going, but keep the neighborhood and the wildlife safe, because a fed bear is really a dead bear. We put them at risk if we choose the birds over the bears.
We're talking with Bridget Butler, the bird diva. She's answering your questions about the bird sightings that you've been excited about in recent weeks. Our number, if you'd like to share a question or a comment, is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your photos, post your questions on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I want to spend a little time talking about birds of prey and raptors. We got a question from Jen, who says, I live near the Upper West Bolton Cliffs. This past weekend, I noticed the ravens and the peregrine falcons in some sort of territorial battle. Can you talk about this? The peregrine pair has nested there for a number of years, and I was wondering if ravens also return year after year to a single nest, or if this is just ruckus for show. And Jen says, if it was a territorial battle, who will win?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that would be a great survey question. Like, who's going to win, the raven or the peregrine? I'm going to put my money on that peregrine because, man, they can move fast and they've got really sharp talons. But yeah, these guys kind of share like a habitat niche. Ravens are kind of known for being up on cliffsides and in higher elevations more so than crows are. They do build nests of sticks. And we do know that raptors oftentimes will kind of co-opt an old crow or raven nest for their own. Peregrines like to nest on the cliffside, and I'm not totally sure if ravens will do the same thing, although it sounds likely. So they probably are battling it out just for who's going to have dominance in that area. I think the peregrine might win, unless it's a first-year juvenile peregrine, and then he just might be, this is too much, it's too stressful, it's my first year, I'm going to move on.
We got a note from Chris who says, I helped one spirited young osprey escape the clutches of 10 or so crows near the landfill in Coventry, last spotted heading towards Memphremagog's South Bay for some lower-risk fishing. Chris says, an eagle also spotted in the Airport Road area soaring high above a few vultures as well as several red tails. And this was all on Friday.
That's awesome. Man, I get excited when turkey vultures come back, too, because they're another one of those first ones. And you know, it's just really cool to see them like tipping back and forth in the sky. Oh, man, an osprey and a crow.
And I'm not sure how Chris helped rescue the osprey, but that's what
I bet you he approached slowly and then he waved his arms a lot. So, you know, those crows and ravens will mob. And what they do is they will gang up and get together. And that's what's wonderful about watching what's going on around you is a lot of time the birds are going to tell you that something's up. So when I'm out looking for raptors or I'm looking for owls, I often pay attention to the other birds because they'll really let me know where that raptor or that owl might be.
Yes, my husband reported that earlier this morning when he was walking in the woods with our son, he saw a bunch of crows chasing a barred owl through the woods.
Wow.
So he could tell where the owl was because the crows were just making such a racket chasing it around the woods.
Good spotting.
Yeah. You accused me, Bridget, of always bringing up bald eagles, but I'm going to do it again.
Okay.
Because there have been a ton of bald eagles sighted in Addison County recently, including Brian Pfeiffer again reporting as many as 22 at a fish kill in Dead Creek, where a bunch of fish were dead, thus a fish kill, because of the icing over of the water.
So Brian had this, you know, question about what's going on with the eagles, and he reached out to this guy named Ian Worley, who's a really great birder, used to work at UVM. Now he's retired and he can bird all the time. So Ian described it as a lack of oxygen underneath the water. So we had so much ice this year, right? And it was so thick. And the ice, when it meets the shoreline, normally that's where there might be little pockets where that, you know, that interplay of the air and the water can mix so that there's still more oxygen. Well, we didn't have that. And then we had such deep frost this year too. So it produced a lot of fish kills all around the area. So if you imagine all the fish that are under the ice, you know, they are using up the oxygen as they just struggle to survive. And so when the ice starts to melt, some of those fish haven't made it because there's a depletion in the oxygen. And then the other crazy thing that Ian said is that when the ice starts to melt, the fish that are still alive are like, you know, they're just dying for a breath. And those holes become the spot where scavengers like bald eagles are all going to hang out. And so what Ian and Brian did was they looked at where some of these sightings were coming in along Dead Creek. And there's some really great pull-off spots, especially as you drive the back roads, because Dead Creek extends quite a long way.
And again, this is in Addison County.
Right.
It's sort of over towards Lake Champlain.
Exactly. And they pinpointed some of the spots where people were seeing a lot of eagles that are just kind of taking advantage of what's happening there. You're probably going to see a lot of other wildlife there too, like otters, raccoons as well, that are all kind of like, yes, this is like a buffet of fish for me, whether it's dead or alive, I'm going to get a meal.
Dead Creek, also known for many, many years now as the spot in the fall where you're likely to see snow geese. And in the last couple of years, it's been a great place to spot snowy owls.
Although there was a snowy owl in Hyde Park this year, which was quite wonderful and posted up just fabulously on the side of the road and then also on a little shed where there was this farm field. And I had the best time packing my three kiddos in the car with their little kid binoculars and snacks and everything. And we got to go up and see a snowy owl for the first time. Pretty cool.
Before we leave the birds with really scary talons part of the conversation, you've been excited about a golden eagle sighting.
Yeah, so turns out it's not really a golden eagle.
Oh.
Any guess?
Juvenile.
There you go. Ding, ding, ding. Juvenile
bald eagle.
So this is one of those tricky IDs. And golden eagles are normally found west of here. We do get them showing up every once in a while. But there was a little bit of scuttlebutt on the Vermont birding page about a potential golden eagle. And it turns out it was most likely a juvenile bald eagle.
Huh.
So the juvenile bald eagles don't have that nice sharp white head and then the dark body and the white tail that the adults do. So they're kind of a mottly color. Sometimes it can be the dark and the white, but then it can also be like dark and brown, which gives you that idea of that golden eagle kind of idea to it. But what you really want to look at is the head and kind of look for that change across the back of the head. Where an immature bald eagle will be really dark, that golden eagle be a light shade. And then kind of rely on your birding buddies to suss that out. It's always, always a good thing to report. So if you think that you got a golden eagle, you want to report it, you want to talk about it, you want to try to snap some photos because that would be a really great report. But, I'm going to say like 9 times out of 10, it's probably an immature bald eagle.
Still pretty cool to see.
Oh my gosh, equally spectacular.
All right, we're talking with bird diva Bridget Butler about quantitative easing and why she thinks the Federal Reserve won't raise interest rates until September at least. Right, Bridget? That's what we're discussing today.
No, please.
No, we're talking birds, and you can tell us what birds you look forward to seeing each spring. Maybe you're getting ready to put that hummingbird feeder up. Just can't wait to see the ruby throats buzzing around your garden. Whatever it is that excites you about birds, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Bridget Butler is with us today. In addition to being the bird diva, she's now the administrative coordinator at Cold Hollow to Canada, an organization that promotes land stewardship and wildlife habitat preservation. So we are going to talk a little bit about habitat. We're also talking about all the birds that you've already been seeing in your neighborhoods this year and what you're most looking forward to. If you have a question, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Pat says, in anticipation of your show, I went for a walk on East Warren Road in Waitsfield. First of the year birds in this location, eastern phoebe, winter wren, yellow-bellied sapsucker, and tree swallows. There are also hundreds of dark-eyed juncos moving around on lawns and fields. And Kathleen says, I just wanted to express my sincere gratitude for all of Vermont's licensed wildlife rehabilitators and the special work they do to help those of us who adore our backyard birds take care of them in the best way possible. I had the opportunity again yesterday to meet up with our songbird rehabilitator for the Northeast Kingdom to transport an injured red-winged blackbird I had discovered in my yard. I keep the Fish and Wildlife map of licensed rehabilitators on my refrigerator, along with other important phone numbers in my life. And let's go to Arthur in Brownington. Hey, Arthur, go ahead.
Yes, we had tree swallows for many, many years, but for the past several years, we've had none, and I'm wondering if there's any way we can attract them.
Yeah, so, you know, birds are associated with different types of habitats, right? So if you have the right habitat, which it sounds like you probably do, so we're looking at nice open fields or grasslands, With, you got to have like a forest nearby because tree swallows are cavity nesters. So they're like one of those species that'll ride the edges between field and forest. So in order to kind of help support them, there's two things you can do. If you're managing that woodland, you want to leave snags up, especially along the edge where it might kind of bleed into the open field, because that's where the swallows will be foraging. Or you can put up nest boxes. And these are the typical bluebird boxes that we see that are rectangular in shape, have a hole that's about an inch and a half to an inch and a quarter wide, and kind of a sloped roof on the top. So those are great for tree swallows. You could put some of those up along the edge of the field, and maybe that would be just what the tree swallows need. It's probably that lack of nesting habitat for them that's making it hard for them to stick around in that area.
And if you're less than familiar with tree swallows, you can go to vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition. We have a couple of photos up on our webpage, and one of them is of a tree swallow.
Awesome.
They're beautiful birds with this iridescent blue back that's
right.
Just gorgeous.
And a white, like really bright white belly, and then this incredible mouth, like short beak but big mouth, because they're going to fly through the air and just gobble stuff up.
Let's go to Lauren calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Hey, great. Good.
Oh, good. I'm so excited to hear all the information about bald eagles coming back to Vermont. And to make it even more exciting, I wanted to share a live eagle cam that's going on in Pennsylvania in Condor State Park. If people go on to lancasteronline.com, all lowercase letters, and click on Live Eagle Cam, you can watch these birds, two adult bald eagles and their eaglets, all day long on this live eagle cam. And I've been watching them since before they were hatched as eggs, and then the whole incubation period. And they have also on Facebook, there's a Facebook page that Hanover, Pennsylvania put up, and it's called Hanover Eagle Watch, and people can join there so that they can comment and also see what the Pennsylvania Game Commission posts daily.
Oh, Lauren, that's so cool. A couple of eagle cams that Lauren's been watching. How fabulous to see those nestlings. Bridget, we have another bald eagle comment or question for you from a listener who says, we've seen bald eagles several times over the past two springs following a river that empties into Lake Champlain. They were flying so low that we're able to clearly identify them as bald eagles, but we also saw a few that looked more like golden eagles. So this listener wants to know if there's an overlap in their territory, or what you were saying earlier, these may be juveniles.
Yeah, so the golden eagle and the bald eagle habitats don't really overlap too much. Even the wintering grounds don't reach over into this area. But we do have, if you look in a field guide, you're going to find on those range maps, you're going to find little dots that kind of show up where we have, you know, sightings that will happen from time to time. And we do have great habitat here for eagles with all of the rivers and with Lake Champlain. But the ones that are nesting, well, nesting more often and really starting to breed here more often are the bald eagles. And one of the cool things that happened this winter, and this is why people see a lot of bald eagles during the winter time, is you know, that ice over happens and bald eagles are trying to work the edges of the ice. So we do get to see them a little bit more often than when they spread out for breeding. And this year was one of the survey years for bald eagles, and it was actually a record year. So there are 15 routes. They need volunteers to go and do this. It's so easy, right? You got to be able to identify one kind of bird. That's it. And they give you a route to drive, and often it's gorgeous. It's along some of these rivers, and you report what you see. This year, their record number was 51 bald eagles, 30 adults, 20 juveniles, and one that they couldn't tell whether it was an adult or juvenile. Most were on Lake Champlain, some in the Connecticut River Valley. Upper Winooski was a new spot, kind of hot spot for them, and Lake Bomazene. And what this survey kind of helps us kind of figure out too is how bald eagles are doing, but then is also going to prepare us for the breeding season. And Vermont is so close to reaching where they need to be in order to delist this bird. So maybe this year will be the year. We had a little bit of a decline last year. We only had 17 pairs And the year before was 26. So we're hoping that that comes up again. And we need successive years of good fledgling success in order to be able to delist these guys. But we're so close.
All right. Fingers crossed.
I know.
Barbara's on the line with us from North Bennington. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I believe it's a bluebird. I'm almost 99.9% positive. And my son had built a birdhouse when he was in first grade. It's a class project, and he's now, we've had it for about 15 years, let's just say that. And
awesome.
Anyway, this is the second time this bluebird family has come back to the house, and we're happy to see them, except for I believe it's the papa bird that our kitchen window's right there, because I like to look out and see the birds. He's constantly coming up to the kitchen window and hitting it. And I feel bad for him because I feel like he feels threatened, like maybe he's seen a reflection of himself. I'm not sure why he's hitting the window, and I didn't know if you had any suggestions.
Yeah, so this happens a lot during this time of year. You know, birds, especially the males, have all these hormones coursing through their body. Their job is territory and finding a mate. And so you're right. He's probably seeing his reflection in the window. And this happens with people with cars, the picture windows, all of that. And so one of the ways that you can help out is by diminishing the glare on the outside of the window. So if you can hang something up, it doesn't sound like that's what you're going to want to do, because this sounds like a window where you like to be able to look out over your property. So I would suggest grabbing some flaggers tape. You can get this in the hardware store. Comes in some really great fluorescent colors. And just sticking that to the outside of the window, a couple different strips, because it'll flutter in the wind. It'll also help break up the reflection. And so hopefully that will keep that male bluebird bashing his head a little bit too much in frustration because he thinks there's another male there.
We got a note from Bailey at Ardelia Farm in Irisburg, and Bailey says, I'm curious about the history of bobolinks in Vermont. Would they have actually been native to the state in pre-colonial times when the state was primarily wooded? In conservation in Vermont, more important now since much of the U.S. native grasslands have been put into agricultural production, when is it safe to make hay to avoid hurting the fledglings? We had a pair in our field last summer and delayed cutting hay as long as we could, and we'd like to help them if we can. We're not making hay this season, but we do plan to graze our goats in this pasture.
Yeah, wow. And the bobolink just has such a great story. I honestly don't know the answer to that part about pre-colonial times, but what you're saying about, you know, Vermont used to be mostly forested and then was clear cut as the settlers came in. And now we're going back to being, you know, almost 80% forested. So the patches that we have kind of left for the bobolink are along the Champlain Valley.
Because the bobolink is a grassland bird.
Exactly.
It needs that sort of, that's why it likes these farm fields.
Right. So it's a grassland species. So there are a number of programs out there. Audubon Vermont's got one. There's one that's called the Bobolink Project. And the Vermont Center for Eco Studies is also, they are like the scientists that are like collecting the data on bobolinks to really understand what their migratory needs are in terms of habitat. So we have all these great organizations doing work. And what they're doing is reaching out to landowners just like you. And they're helping assess your property to look at the different grassland birds that you might have there. So we've got bobolinks, you know, we have things like the eastern meadowlark, upland sandpiper, grasshopper sparrow that all love to take advantage of these places. But they also nest in the grass. And so that's a conflict with landowners that are trying to, well, feed their animals, goats, cows, sell hay. And so the recommendation in general is July 15th. If you can delay your first cut until July 15th, you're going to give those birds a chance to get their first brood off. Some of these birds, if they have enough energy and it's not too threatening of a year when it comes to weather, they will nest again. But the general recommendation is to hold off until July 15th. You can reach out to the folks at the Bobolink Project, which is through Connecticut and I believe University of Vermont. Audubon Vermont also has the Champlain Valley Grassland Bird Initiative. And then the Vermont Center for Eco Studies. Oh my gosh, if you haven't seen their brand new newsletter, it is gorgeous. It's called Field Notes. It has the hottest looking upland sandpiper on the front page, and it's all about grassland conservation.
Well, you've been thinking about that a lot as well lately, Bridget, and not just for bobolinks and meadowlarks, but also for warblers?
Yeah, for warblers as well. So, you know, what's really fascinating is there's this movement in conservation now, and I was really inspired to read this piece that David Attenborough wrote recently about
the famed British naturalist.
Right, with the British accent. Right. Oh, I love him. He's so fun to listen to. And he did this talk where he talked about it's not enough for just to have private lands, right? So it's not enough just to have our state parks and our refuges and things like that. What we really have to get down to is private landowners and private lands. And, you know, any of these habitats that we look at, the majority of the property that's left is owned by private landowners, whether it's grassland or forest early successional habitat. And so that's where we need to go, and that's where we need to focus now when it comes to conservation. And we need to support landowners in doing what they need to do. If you're a farmer, you need to hay your field. If you're someone who owns forested property, you might need to have a timber sale. You might take wood off of your property to heat your home. But there are ways that you can do this that will keep wildlife in mind. And birds are this great umbrella species. So if you're passionate about birds and you think about how you can manage in a bird-friendly way, then you're going to do a lot of great things for mammals, reptiles, and amphibians as well.
So if you're a landowner with a lot of land or maybe a woodlot, where do you go to find out how to do that?
Sure. So what's great is that all of these organizations are kind of collaborating now in Vermont. So I would say the first person that you might want to go to if you are a forest landowner is find out who your county forester is. And Forest Parks and Recreation has been working very closely with Audubon Vermont to kind of across the whole state look at bird-friendly silvicultural practices. If you are a farmer, you probably want to go to NRCS or your local ag representative. And again, some of the folks from the Bobolink Project and from Audubon Vermont are working with those farmers to be able to figure out what's best for you in your situation and how can we make it work for birds and what you need to do.
It's all birds, all hour today. It's the Vermont Edition Spring Bird Show with bird diva Bridget Butler. Bridget, we've got a couple of bird ID questions for you coming up. And listeners, if you have a question you'd like to share or a sighting, call 1-800-639-2211. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're getting the lowdown on what birds are back in our neighborhoods and what they're up to. Like many of us, it's home renovation and construction season. So for the birds, too, they're building nests. Also, time to mate, of course. Maybe that's not for us, but certainly for the birds at this time of year. You can tell us what birds you're seeing and what mating behavior you find perplexing. We've got bird diva Bridget Butler with us for a little while longer. So if you have a question, now is the time to call. 1-800-639 2211. If you can't get through, you can always post your comments on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. There are lots of us here. Let's crowdsource some answers for people who have bird questions, and we'd love to see your pictures there. So the Vermont Edition Facebook page, a great place to continue this conversation. But Bridget, we have people who have questions for you. Miles says, I saw four loons flying fast on my walk through Wilmington, Vermont this morning. What are those loons up to this time of year?
They are like, oh my gosh, where is the open water? Somebody help me fast.
And
right?
That's so cool. I never see flying loons. That's a really cool sighting.
Oh my gosh, four together. I can't imagine how hard it's got to be a loon. Right now, thick ice, it's not melting really quickly. You know, and these guys are designed to be on the water. So if a loon even tries to land on land, it's not going to be pretty at all.
Because they need a really big run up in the water to get back into flight,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, to get back into flight. Their legs are further on the back of their body than what a land bird would be, right? To balance the whole land bird's body out. They're on the water most of the time, and they're swimmers, so they're designed that way. The legs are further back.
And they have very heavy bones.
Yeah, so, you know, not good for flying, and, you know, you got to have water to land in. So, you know, this is where that woman that mentioned wildlife rehabbers can be really important during this time of year, especially for birds like loons, who sometimes can get fooled by parking lots, where you get a little bit of rain and that parking lot looks a lot like water. And some of these birds are probably going to be a little bit tired out and they really need a place to land. That loon, if he tumbles down through into that parking lot, it's not going to be able to get back again. So you want to find a wildlife rehabilitator. They're listed on the Vermont Fish and Wildlife webpage as well to kind of help you out to be able to get that bird back to the water, because that's where they're going to be able to take off and keep going.
And bottom line for Miles, what those loons were doing was looking for some open water.
Yeah, looking for open water, trying to find a place to set up a territory. And mate.
Let's go to Julie in Westminster. Hi, Julie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a couple of comments, and I have a question. My first comment is that I was a participant in the WIP program, I delayed my mowing until, they said, after the 1st of August, and I've had a tremendous increase in the number of bobolinks because of it. And even after the 1st, they're often here for up to 2 weeks just eating the seeds and the grasses. So I think it's important that they have that ability to feed after they're born and flying around. And the other comment was that the red wings were 2 weeks late this year. I normally see them around the 10th of March, and this week they were very late in the southeast area. And the third thing is that the Carolina wren, I've been hearing that in the area, and it seems like a new addition. And I'm wondering if the Carolina wren has just recently come to Vermont, or has it been here for a while?
I think they've been here for a while. I seem to recall that this is one of those species whose range has expanded. And so we are seeing more of them. I know I live up in the northern part of the state, so I was surprised to hear them. And so they are becoming a little bit more common. I want to clarify, she said the WIP programs, and I want to make sure people understand what this is. This is a cost-sharing program. It's called the Wildlife Habitat Incentives Program, and your county forester can help you get connected with that. Because if you're a landowner and you want to do good things for wildlife and for birds, there is, you know, sometimes it costs to brush hog or to plant trees or to restore your stream banks. And there are a lot of cost-sharing programs out there that are available to kind of help you do good stuff for birds.
Fabulous. All right, let's go to Kitty in Burlington. Hey, Kitty.
Hi, Jane and Bridget. How are you?
We're good.
Great. I have a question about finches.
Okay.
I heard on this radio station a few days ago or a week ago that finches' color can be determined by what they eat.
Yeah.
First of all, is that true?
Yes, it is.
Yes? And then if so, is there something I can plant that would help
increase their hotness?
What they eat? Excuse
yeah.
me?
Yeah, sure. It's really funny because, you know, female birds key off of this. So, you know, if a male bird has those really nice, robust red tones to them and on cedar waxwings and such, it's like those little waxy tips on the ends of the wings. So color can be enhanced a lot by what the bird is eating, especially berries. So berry-producing bushes like viburnums and the dogwoods are going to do really good things for these birds. So a male bird that's well-fed is more attractive to the female bird, and she's going to pair up with him quicker. So there's some great books out there. There's one by the National Audubon Society that is all about gardening for birds in your backyard. And I got to say, you know, we've been talking about habitat and large landowner, you know, people that own a lot of land. It's not just about that. It's about what we can do in our backyard as well. For stopovers for some of these birds. So even though they might not nest in our backyard, a lot of times they can use our backyard in terms of food, in terms of shelter, and a good resting spot. So it's not just the big landowners that can do good. Small landowners can do so as well.
Do you remember the name of that book that you were talking about?
Yes, it's the Audubon. No, I can't. I can put it on the
Vermont Edition
Vermont
page.
Edition
at
page. Yeah, it's something National Audubon Society Guide to Landscaping for Birds in your backyard
probably gives
and beyond.
Enough to go for.
Pretty much like that.
Awesome. Thanks, Bridget. Let's go to Melanie in North Bennington. Hi, Melanie.
Hi.
Hi.
I don't know if anybody's mentioned this, but we have an eagle in North Bennington.
Fabulous. That's really good. Have you reported this yet? Have you logged this on eBird?
Just now.
Yay! Good. That is fabulous. You know, and this is
and
the...
You're not the only one who's seen it? Go right ahead. Say that again.
Yes. Melanie. Yes, I'm not the only one that's seen it. And it's magnificent.
Yeah, they are really quite awe-inspiring. You know, I've done a program before where we've held up silhouettes of bald eagles, you know, that are life-size. And one of the things that you really don't understand when you see a bird from a distance is how big it really is. And, you know, these guys have a 6-foot wingspan. I mean, and that's pretty amazing. That's a huge, huge bird. What I was going to say is yay for reporting it, because what we've learned about bald eagles nesting in the state, it's something like 80% 40% of the nest sites that we've learned about have been reported by private citizens. And so that's really important. We have one migratory bird biologist for the state. He can't be everywhere all the time, so we can be the eyes and the ears. And also, sometimes you want to keep it on the down low, okay? So we want to keep it quiet where some of these nests are so the birds are protected. You know, people get really excited about bald eagles and they want to see them. One of the recommendations is to stay as far away as you possibly can. Grab some binoculars, grab a scope, 300 yards. So like the length of a football field. If you hear the eagle start going, kick, 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 you know, almost sounding like an osprey and sending out a warning call, that means you're too close. You're stressing the bird and we don't want to do that during nesting season.
All right, Bridget, I promised an ID question for you. I know you love them. Catherine emailed in to say, yesterday at the suet feeder, I saw a gorgeous bird. So Catherine's question is, was it a flicker? And here are the bullet points that Catherine has. The bird had gunmetal color, solid, its head, chest, belly. A gorgeous red-orange cap on the top and back of the head, beautiful sharp edge to the shape of the cap. Black eyes. Beak, dark, about 3/4 inch long and narrow. It hit the suet like a woodpecker and seemed ravenous. Wings were barred like a woodpecker, and it had a bit of yellow-orange above the beak, a dusty light coloring.
Okay, wow. That is like one killer description. That's really, really fabulous. Okay.
And yet, even so, Bridget is flicking through her bird book.
I do, right? Because, you know, my picture, what I see in my head may not be the same as what somebody else sees. So for me, when I watch flickers, it's the butt of the bird again, right? So they have on the upper butt, which is, you know, the top part of the tail from the back down, there's a white patch that often shows up when this bird is in flight. And woodpeckers, they can be confusing, right? So they've all got like a little bit of red on the head, and they feed in the similar way and they've got that long bill. But for each woodpecker, there's kind of a thing to hold on to. So for me, for flickers, it's this butt patch, this white patch. But you are correct. You got all these great characteristics, that gunmetal gray color, the patchiness, you know, across the back and the belly is really good. The size of the beak, yay for you for looking at the size of the beak. When we look at birds, we really want to try to get as much information as we can, as quick as we can. And the head has a lot of info, and beaks can be one of those clinchers. So I think you got a northern flicker there. Nice.
That's great. Nice job, Catherine.
Yeah.
And Arthur wants to know about how to get rid of a couple of feeder pests. Now, we talked earlier about not keeping your feeders up during bear season, but if you're in a place that doesn't have bears, or at any rate, here's Arthur's question.
Okay.
European starlings for the first time at our feeders, and grackles in all caps with 2 exclamation marks. I take it Arthur does not like grackles, and he wants your thoughts on abatement of these greedy bullies.
Okay, so here's the quick and dirty. Clean up your seed. Anything that falls on the ground, you really want to clean it up, because these guys will go to the ground first before they go to the feeder. What you're feeding, don't get that stuff at the grocery store. Go get straight up black oil sunflower seed, because you don't want anything that has those little round seeds in it. That's like millet, and all the unwanted birds, unfortunately, like that stuff. And then the last thing would be to invest in some feeders that are weighted, so that the weight of the bird, especially if you have gobblers like blue jays that just like pig out on whatever you put, you can set the weight sensitivity so the feeder will close and won't feed the heavier birds.
That's so mean.
I know. Go get it somewhere else. It's expensive to feed birds, man.
All right. That's Bridget Butler. She is the bird diva, and she's now the administrative coordinator at Cold Hollow to Canada. That's an organization that promotes land stewardship and wildlife habitat preservation. Bridget, thank you as always.
Awesome time, Jane. Thanks so much. Thanks all you callers for making it so much fun.
I also want to say that Tim sent us a beautiful picture of an enormous barred owl. He says, this barred owl has been visiting our home in the Stowe Hollow area. We also had a snowy owl but didn't get a picture. We have Tim's picture on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Go there to see it for yourself and post your own. And that wraps up today's show. Maybe you went for a leisurely bike ride to look at some birds in the gorgeous weather yesterday. But a lot of Vermonters don't just bike for fun. They rely on bicycles as their mode of transportation. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about the accessibility of bike commuting and the roadblocks that keep some people from getting on their bikes. Email your experience to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.